that have evolved in isolation, like the Khabib squirrel. McKinnon is also concerned about some of the last standing old growth ponderosa pine, which is the only spots left from logging in the 1900s. And lastly, he's concerned about the Apache trout, Arizona state fish. McKinnon also says that this fire could benefit some areas of the landscape that have likely not burned in a long time. He says, quote, I think...
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is...
Getting back to the story on the fire in the Grand Canyon, I'll pick it up here. McKinnon also says that this fire could benefit some areas of the landscape that have likely not burned in a long time. He says, quote, I think there's some cause for cautious optimism in some cases with regard to the forest, and there are some cases where I think we need to get ready for some significant changes from what we're used to in seeing up here. This report is informed by reporting from OPB's Ryan Henzius.
Proposed cuts to federal low-income home energy assistance programs may leave people without heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. A federal government initiative called the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, has made headlines in recent months. In April, the Trump administration fired LIHEAP staffers, and the president has proposed cutting the program entirely. LIHEAP has existed for decades and helps families who are struggling to pay their energy bills. Low-income households can apply to LIHEAP via states, local governments, and community groups, and receive funding to pay for part of their bills. This money is usually sent directly to the utility company to help cover the cost of oil, gas, or electric heat. In some cases, the funding helps prevent imminent shutoffs or restores people's service, so it can be a critical lifeline, especially during the cold winter months. And in some states, LIHEAP can help pay for air conditioning in the summer, keeping people safe during extreme heat waves. To help reduce people's need for energy in the first place, the program also often funds retrofits like home air sealing and insulation. Last year, more than 50 million U.S. residents struggled to pay at least one energy bill. So many families are anxious to learn if they will still be able to rely on support from LIHEAP to help them stay safe and comfortable in their homes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
These algae-based plastic alternatives will reduce petroleum-based plastic waste globally while offering biodegradable solutions. Mandy Stapleford has more on the story.
Good news, good planet, good news.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. Ocean algae plastic. Around the world, fertilizer runoff into oceans causes invasive seaweed blooms that are wreaking havoc by causing marine suffocation, reducing water quality, and blocking out sunlight. Meanwhile, plastic waste appears to be an endless, ongoing global environmental problem. A Finnish company is tackling both issues. Biochemist Mari Granström has invented a way to turn harmful algae blooms into an asset by harvesting the microalgae in seaweed to create a remarkable alternative plastic. Her company, Origin by Ocean, collects microalgae from the Baltic Sea and imports invasive sargassum seaweed from the Dominican Republic. They process the seaweed into materials that can be used in a wide range of applications. These algae-based plastic alternatives will reduce petroleum-based plastic waste globally while offering biodegradable solutions. Algae's natural gelling abilities hold up in a way that mimics many plastic properties while breaking down easily in nature in weeks instead of centuries. It's also bacteria resistant, requires no additional feeding or inputs, and can be grown abundantly in oceans without using valuable agricultural lands. Origin by Ocean intends to be a powerful weapon in the fight against plastic pollution, as well as a way to manage an out-of-control marine plant problem. Two birds, one ingenious stone equals one happier planet. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is James Kemp, Dave Johnson, and Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Brian Bull, and Dr. Anthony Lisowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. I'm off again this week, so you're going to hear the second half of one of my favorite interviews that I've done with author and activist Rand Schenck, which I first released last year in July of 2024. I love this conversation, but I feel like it needs a little context at this point, since 2024 seems like a millennia ago, and the fierce arguments that forest defenders and policymakers were having about forest management now seem like friendly disagreements. Obviously, our politics have undergone a Cascadia megathrust level shift since I recorded this interview, and the politics and management of public lands is very much caught up in that devastation. So some of the topics we covered in this interview, like to what extent the Forest Service was acting in good faith versus bad faith, feel like moot points now, and others, like Biden's mature and old growth rule and the Northwest Forest Plan Amendment, have been scrapped entirely. With that said, Rand's book about the history of the Forest Service is just as relevant today and gives some important perspective on the changing nature of how we value forests and how those values affect the forests themselves. And I'd like to think that our conversation still holds some relevance as well, but that's for you to judge. Speaking of judging, let me know your verdict on the show. My email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com, and all of our episodes are available for free on any podcast app. I'm also so grateful to be carried on community radio stations across Oregon and up into Washington. I make this show for free, but local media needs your support now more than ever. So please donate to your community radio station, subscribe to your local paper if you have one, and if you have any goodwill left over, tell your friends about Coast Range Radio. Finally, we did cut some stuff out that's just totally irrelevant now. So in lieu of that, stay tuned at the end of the show for a song I recorded a while back with my band, The Road Sodas. If you like it, you can download our music for free at theroadsodas.com. This is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Today's episode is part two of my interview with Rand Schenck, author of a great new book on the history of the Forest Service, its founder Gifford Pinchot, and over 100 years of forest management and mismanagement in the Pacific Northwest. The book, titled Forest Under Siege, The Story of Old Growth After Gifford Pinchot, chronicles the Forest Service's progressive populist origins, how it abandoned its founding mission of conservation and drove our old-growth forests to the brink of extinction, and how, or if, the agency is entering a new restoration ecology era. In part one of our interview, we covered the story of the Forest Service from its humble beginnings through the era of hubris and destruction, and ended that episode with the creation of the Northwest Forest Plan. On today's episode, we really get into the big questions around how the Forest Service wants to manage national forests for the next generation, whether they can be trusted in that mission, and how we can protect our public lands right now. Forest Under Siege is available at local bookstores throughout the Northwest, and you can order a copy online by searching for Forest Under Siege. Okay, let's get on with the show. We are in the midst of dual rulemaking processes that will address, to some degree, for better and or for worse, you know, questions that are longstanding around how to manage national forests, especially around mature and old growth. And I'm really conflicted about the role of the Forest Service in this. You know, on the one hand, they are unquestionably better stewards of forests than any industrial timberland owner. You know, where I'm sitting, surrounded by industrial timberland, I would love to see the worst that the Forest Service can do outside my front porch instead of the best that Weyerhaeuser does, right? But on the other hand, it is really hard to trust that this new ecological forestry and restoration language that the Forest Service uses is based in good faith rather than euphemistic sort of smokescreens for getting the cut out like they've always tried to do. So I have more to say and more questions, but the first question is just, after your long history of environmental advocacy and then this massive project of writing Forest Under Siege, your new book, how do you view the current iteration of the Forest Service in terms of, do you trust where they are coming from and that they are making a good faith effort?
Yeah, there's a wonderful phrase that I always like to fall back onto out of the Middle East about trust in Allah, but tether your camel, which means that we really also need to pay attention to what's happening on the ground. We need to pay attention to the planning process. We need to continue to provide input to these processes underway right now with these amendments to the forest plans. That's all about ground truthing. That's all about, as I put it, tether your camel. The trust is not enough. But let me talk first about the trust piece.
Yeah.
The culture of the Forest Service has changed. Absolutely from the high production phase that was dominated by the old school guys and almost entirely guys, men, who grew up within the Forest Service beginning, you know, from the 40s into the 50s. And they were the people who came into power, into leadership in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And as a result, particularly of the National Forest Management Act in the 70s and then into the 80s, we saw the hiring of a lot of different people. And we saw a lot of diversity coming into the Forest Service. We saw women coming into the Forest Service. We saw people of color coming into the Forest Service. We saw researchers, scientists coming into the Forest Service. We saw what the old guard called the ologists, biologists, ecologists, hydrologists, all these, quote, ologists. These were people with expertise in their professions, bringing that expertise, that understanding of ecology, of hydrology, of salmon, of the birds, the murrelet, and the needs of the spotted owl. All that expertise was coming into the Forest Service. And what did that lead to? I do believe, and it did have led to a change in the culture of the Forest Service. And so that's kind of where I come from in terms of saying, yeah, there has been a cultural shift for sure. But there's still this but. There are parts of the old culture that remain, and that some aspect of that, quote, get out the cut ethic. There's still some, I might, hopefully it's the death throes of that culture that has not been eliminated. And that's where we, quote, need to tether our camel and need to continue to do ground truthing, continue to have and rely on the highly professional environmental organizations out there that have staff that can look at the plans, that can look at the sales that are being proposed, and tell us if there's a problem with that. And so, you know, this we're going to have to see and take a close look at these amendments that are coming out. And here is one more change that I'll put out there that is totally was not in anyone's mind in the Forest Service in 1990. And that is the climate crisis, climate chaos, The forest, and here is the probably one of the most significant changes that has occurred in the national forest in those 30 years. We've gone from where our national forests were a huge carbon source to now where they are a highly significant carbon sink. These forests are among the most carbon-dense forests in the world. And so we have this huge opportunity to build on that. And that's really what we especially need to pay attention to. And that's, again, part of my hope, is there is this recognition of this, you know, existential crisis we are facing and the need to help address bringing down carbon into our forests so that we can sequester and ultimately help meet our climate goals.
Yeah. And I'm glad you're bringing in the hope piece. You know, reading your book, I went through the full range of emotions, and, you know, the part two, the high production phase was really, you know, heartbreaking for somebody that's grown up in the Pacific Northwest and cares so much about these forests. But you do go into that third phase, that new era, and do, you know, end with, I would say, well-grounded hope in the book. So, just another plug for our listeners to go out and get Forest Under Siege. I also want to say another piece of the pressure there is the Forest Service can have the best intentions in the world. I'm not saying they do or don't, but they could. And there's still two other very powerful pieces of the Iron Triangle that are still alive and well, and that is political pressure and the timber industry, which is still pushing those same talking points and still trying to find ways, you know, currently, as we've talked about on this program before, using wildfire as a scare tactic to apply pressure to get the cut out, what have you. An example of why folks like myself have this lingering distrust of the agency, even though we want to view them as an ally rather than adversary. Look at what happened after the 2020 Labor Day fires. The Forest Service immediately planned massive roadside cutting in national forest land under the name of public safety, including on primitive and extremely low traffic roads in the national forest. They could have chosen to simply close these roads permanently, which would have been a 2-for-1 win for ecological restoration, because, as I still want to touch on, they have way, way too many roads on the national forest. And as you talk about in your book, it has been conclusively demonstrated that leaving these landscapes alone after an ecological disturbance is the quickest, best path to restoration. So instead, even in the face of widespread public backlash, they opted for getting the cutout, and they were largely successful in that, even though I will say, thanks to public pressure, they had to pull way back from their original plan. So you can speak on that if you want, but I just wanted to make sure and get that point out as well as an example of the ongoing tension there.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I agree with that. And, you know, it's interesting to know. I mean, I would love to know and have been on the fly on the wall when the Forest Service leaders were having that conversation about mm-hmm. how to address the consequences of the Labor Day fires, and what really was motivating them to get that level of cut on these roads when they could have just closed down. And they need to close down mm-hmm. not just hundreds of miles of roads, thousands of miles of road. You asked me earlier, you know, about the change in the roaded system. Over about a 30-year period during that high production phase, the percentage of roads increased by 700%. 700%, up to over 4,300 miles of roads in this one national forest. And so just crazy road building, but that was about getting into the inaccessible backcountry so that they could cut all the old growth. But now, you know, clearly, you know, we are about restoration. We are about ecological management. I will say, you know, this, I point this out in my book, that I kind of feel like that there are sort of two approaches that can be taken now in terms of, and really we have a short period of time to operate in terms of all these timber plantations. We have a tremendous amount that's, quote, you know, the Forest Service succeeded in transforming a good amount of the forest from a natural forest to a timber plantation. We want to get that timber plantation back to a natural forest. How do we do that? When some cases, we absolutely just need to leave it alone. There will be other fires that come through. There will be insect infestations. There will be wind disturbances that will blow down all kinds of trees. And we will have, as a result of that, what Jerry Franklin calls biological legacies, which leads to incredible biodiversity. We just need to leave it alone. But there is some part of that, those plantations, we probably can, we can go in and do some very prescriptive thinning where we are leaving the best trees leaving the conditions so that mature and old growth can develop in those, and we can get back to a more natural forest. So I think there are both approaches that we can use moving forward to get a more of a natural forest. We'll never have what we had 150 years ago. It will be different, but we can move towards a more natural forest given these right practices over the next 100 years.
Rand, you set me up perfectly for the segue that I wanted to make, so thank you for that. So near the end of the book, you write, one of the most vital questions that can be asked is, to restore natural forests, do we simply let Mother Nature do her work and leave forests alone, or will active forest management facilitate the transformation of plantations more quickly into forests with old growth characteristics? So you're right, I think that is one of the most vital questions, right? So where do you land on this? Do you think the Forest Service is finding the right balance? And where are they and where are they not finding that balance in your perception?
I'll give you one example that I think is highly illustrative of what you're talking about here. Early on in the research of my book, I had a chance to interview Emily Platt. And at that point, she was the executive director of the Gifford-Pinchot Task Force, an environmental organization focused on the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest and ensuring the Forest Service was hopefully going to do the right things and how that they manage that forest. Some years later, she left that role, got a degree in forestry, and became the district ranger for the Mount Adams District in the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. And she designed a project up in the Wind River District of the Mount Adams District, the Wind River's watershed. She designed a project. And I looked at that project to see assess whether it was going to do the right stuff. And was it going to try to create the conditions that more mature and old growth trees would mature? And she had a graph in that. And the graph showed that both over the previous 20 years in that national forest, so since the Northwest Forest Plan, that the percentage of old growth had increased pretty high, to a pretty high level. And that with the what they were looking to do in this particular national forest, I'm sorry, in this particular area, that they would create the conditions through some prescriptive thinning to allow more mature and old growth trees to develop. But at the same time, she also wanted to create some early seral habitat to do some to what is now called restoration thinning or clear cutting, which is there can be good reasons for some of that, limited. Since her plan had come into place, there had been one of the Labor Day fires that happened not only in Oregon, happened in that Wind River watershed just north of where my cabin is, called the Big Hollow Fire. It burned 20,000 acres in the Wind River watershed and burned severely a good part of that. And so you were naturally going to have early seral habitat as a result of these severe burns. Well, the Forest Service didn't take that into account. And so they had to be challenged around that by what is now the Cascade Forest Conservancy. And they did acknowledge, oh, well, actually, yeah, you're right, that there will be this early seral habitat. Perhaps we don't need to do as much clear cutting. So on the one hand, you have the Forest Service moving to do the right thing in order to create conditions right for mature and old growth to develop, but still going back to some, clear cutting practices that in this case simply were not necessary. So I think that it's on the one hand, and on the other, we see movement in the right direction in many cases, but we see some practices that still are questionable. And that's where we have the need to continue to pay close attention to what's happening on the ground. I just don't see that going away.
Absolutely, right. We cannot let our guard down, even if we want to believe they have good intention. We have to keep that pressure up. Absolutely. I don't know if this is outside of the scope of our conversation or not, but just on this note of trust and distrust in the agency, like, something I've long thought is that the trauma, both to like the ecology, the landscape, and to the communities, both the communities that relied on the timber output of that unsustainable level of cutting, and the folks like you and me who care so deeply about these forests, like, I just don't think that's ever really been healed, and the damage, certainly not ecologically repaired yet, but in the communities. And I just wonder if you think the agency should do more to acknowledge and repair the harms that they've inflicted. And when I say that, I'm not imputing bad intention on anyone, but the harms they inflicted are real, both, like I say, on the landscape, decimated rural communities, and the people that care so deeply about these forests. And I just wonder if more acknowledgement, more humility from the Forest Service would go a long way there.
The key word there that you bring in to the conversation is humility. And what we saw for so long was arrogance on the part of the Forest Service, that they knew best. And so, Michael, I think you've got a tremendous, really important point that you're making here, is how to raise the issue. How could the Forest Service express humility, express some regret that what happened was hurtful to a whole range of communities, that there were, quote, mistakes made? And that not that I don't think we can make reparations of any sort, but I think there could be some at least symbolic actions that could be taken. And, you know, and that could go up to certainly Forest Service supervisors here in the Pacific Northwest. And it, probably more important, you know, would be, you know, Region 6, which represents all of the Pacific Northwest, but even going up to the chief of the Forest Service. That's really where the accountability truly lies, with the chief of the Forest Service. So it would be an extraordinary act on the part of the chief of the Forest Service to come to the Pacific Northwest, as Clinton did in 1993, to come to the Pacific Northwest, to bring together the key stakeholders, people from rural communities, indigenous communities, loggers, environmental community, bring those people together and have some way of atoning for the past practices that were not helpful here, and acknowledging the harms. Again, how that would play out, I don't know, but I think it could be tremendously symbolic, and symbolism can be important to acknowledge all that, and to say, you know, and partly perhaps as a result of the amendments that are taking place, to say, we are going to take this in a different direction now. We are in a time of healing. I talk about ultimately what happened here is I put a Buddhist frame on it. I talk about the life, the death, and rebirth of the forest. And we are hopefully now truly are in the rebirth of the forest. And so there could be some way of marking that moment, that we are truly entering and hope to sustain this as a long-term movement into the rebirth of the forest and the rebirth of old growth.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thanks for indulging me in that. We just have never really fully healed those wounds.
Michael, I think just one way, if I could just read the last little bit of from my book, I think there's a couple of paragraphs here that I think really shine a light on just what you're talking about in terms of where we're headed or where we need to head for the future. Would that be appropriate now?
Absolutely. And once again, you've nailed the transition I was about to try to make. So yeah, please.
All right. This is the last paragraph from my book. During our current era of uncertainty, given the magnitude of the climate crisis about whether we will have a habitable planet in 100 years, when millions of people are fleeing their native lands in response to severe droughts, this period when the threats of terrorism and pandemics magnify so many people's anxiety, the need is greater than ever to have natural, awe-inspiring forests where we can reconnect with nature. Yes, we need to use all the tools of ecosystem management and biodiversity conservation at our disposal. Yes, we need to use always the best science available to guide us. Yes, we need to protect our Pacific Northwest forests as they are such an important element in addressing the climate crisis. Above all, we need to act with humility given how much we do not know, and to act with great patience and caution given future unanticipated changes. We cannot know how our Pacific Northwest forests will evolve, and thus we must work to keep all our options open so we have even more flexibility in our decisions and actions in the future. Beyond carbon sequestration and storage, beyond recreation pursuits, beyond providing life-giving water, we need to restore our forests to allow us to, as Gifford Pinchot III so eloquently stated, his grandson, quote, seize what is a deeper part of our nature, end quote. We need the forests more than ever for the spiritual solace they provide us.
Well, Rand, I had more questions for you, but I think that is a really beautiful place to start to wrap us up, actually. And for folks wanting to learn more, just get the book. That book is Forest Under Siege. And as you mentioned, you can find it at Powell's. You can find it at a number of other places.
Yeah, the book can easily be purchased online through the publisher, Washington State University Press, WSU Press, online. Powell's obviously will have a copy. Other bookstores in the area will have copies as well. But certainly they can be purchased online.
Rand, unless there's anything we've missed, I just want
this to... This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1970.